Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society. With me, science journalist Izzy Clark, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and the Society's Deputy Director, Dr. Robert Massey.
This is the place where we dive into the supermassive mailbox even more to tide you all over between normal episodes and we answer some more of your questions.
But before we get into the questions, we have to do a shout out to Mai Johansson, who has emailed us to say, "Hi guys, I would just like to thank you for awakening my childhood love or obsession with space. I work as a doctor and realized how much I missed physics and space, so now I'm taking a part-time class that is basically how space works for people who know a little but not super much in my free time at a university. Shout out to Linnaeus University. Much love from Sweden." How nice is that?
So good. That's so nice. I'm so glad we could help in rekindling that passion.
Are we influencers? Awesome. I think we're influencers. The look of concern on Becky's face right there. Okay, so Becky, can you help with this question from Mike in Oregon? They say, "The bicep experiment was fooled by dust. Tired light is caused by dust. The dimming and brightening of Betelgeuse is thought to have been due to dust. There's so much dust everywhere, but what is the dust that is so ubiquitous in the cosmos? Love the podcast, Mike in Oregon."
Well, I like to say that dust is supernova poop, Mike. I feel like it is the best description of what it is.
That's really just not what I was expecting this to go. But I love it. Carry on.
Description. I don't know what else to call it because that is literally what it is, right? It is the heavier elements, things like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, that are produced by stars as like they put off dying, right? They've run out of hydrogen, so they scramble and they're like, "Oh, let's convert the helium. Oh, let's convert the carbon." And then when they do eventually die and go supernova or nova or just fizzling out, like, they spread those elements back out into the universe. And then they clump together and they form like grains of dust that are like, you know, like micrometers across, right? They're pretty small, but there's still enough of it that it does block our view sometimes. And so there's sort of like many, like almost like layers of dust. We have solar system dust. We then have Milky Way dust. You have dust in galaxies themselves that sometimes block our views of like the centers. And so when you do look out into the universe, you have to take that into account all the time. So for example, like one of the most cited astronomy papers ever is a map of dust across the sky and the amount it affects light coming in that specific direction, because you always have to correct your data by that amount, and that's why it's the most cited paper because everybody has to use it. Schlegel et al. Shout out Schlegel et al. And it is funny that, you know, so many people have had to make careers out of studying dust like that, so that we can, you know, we want it understand dust itself, because actually dust can act as a catalyst for star formation. So it's sort of like a shortcut for making what we call molecular hydrogen, so H2, yeah. Two, like O2, you know, like two hydrogen atoms bonded together, and that's what you need to make stars, and it's a bit of a shortcut for that. And it also blocks like cosmic rays and UV light that can then break apart those molecular hydrogens, so it also keeps them stuck together in the first place. It's about 1% of the mass of the entire galaxy, right? That's more than the black hole, right? It's not the supermassive black hole at the center, right? It's not an insignificant amount. But what I love is, yeah, people have made whole careers of studying it. Like Brian May, for example, his PhD thesis was about, you know, the solar system dust no one else cares about.
Are we going to have to add dust to the list, aren't we, for like future episodes?
We have to.
Yeah, it's going to have to happen. Okay, Robert, David Chris Gore has this question. He says, "Hi team, first, I love the pod and I adore the Year in Space book. It's glorious. Avid watcher of Dr. B's YouTube channel too, and recently finished A Brief History of Black Holes." I mean, all the plugs. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
So my burning question, having watched The Marvels on Disney Plus last night, is Captain Marvel uses her power to reignite a dying sun. Is it actually possible, or is a dying sun simply going to expire no matter what? All the best, Dave.
Thanks for that, Dave. Massive plugs there. I think reigniting the sun, or any sun for that matter, would make us absolutely godlike. I mean, firstly, should reassure
it's Captain
people.
Marvel. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. unless everything we know about stars is wrong, there's no way that our sun, for example, is suddenly going to shut down, even, because it's got lots of fuel. You know, plenty of gravitational energy driving that reaction in the center, generating energy from fusing hydrogen to helium, There's lots of hydrogen left, so there's no reason to believe it will suddenly shut down. But if it did, there's pretty much nothing we could do about it. You see these films like Sunshine and so on. But the idea of even delivering the most powerful nuclear weapon we have into the heart of the sun would be nowhere near enough. Well, it would be impossible to get it there, and that would be nowhere near enough energy to change it. But I did come across, I was looking around this, I thought this is one of those crazy questions. And sure enough, it turns out people have thought about how you could do things like prolong the sun's life, so or to change it. And one idea is to take a passing star, which is obviously a trivial exercise, move it near the sun, stir up the outer layers of the sun to drive more hydrogen into the center to fire up the reaction again. So, you know, nice and easy, I guess the sort of thing the Marvels could manage. That it could also prolong the life of the sun by breaking it or removing mass to make it more like a red dwarf, which has the minor side effect of making it a lot cooler as well. So we'd have to simultaneously move the Earth closer. So a few little things to get in place to manipulate this stuff, or even make a ring of red dwarfs somehow. You know, this is all bonkers stuff. And I have to say that, you know, either sadly or fortunately, depending on your perspective, I think there's pretty much no prospect of us being able to do any of those things.
That was all starting to sound a little bit like the Mistborn trilogy by Brandon Sanderson. For anybody who's read that out there, they'll know what I'm talking about.
Okay. Vicky, can you answer this question from Brian Smithson? They say, greetings from rainy South Carolina. My question is, how do we know what galaxy a given star is in? Couldn't it be in front of or behind a galaxy of interest? Love the show. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, I mean, behind a galaxy of interest is very unlikely, because if we think about individual stars compared to the brightness of an entire galaxy, you know, of billions of stars, we're never going to spot a single star unless it's like lensed. So people might remember Urundel, the most distant star ever spotted. That was spotted by the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's since been looked at by JWST as well. That was like lensed, magnified by sort of the curvature of space, by gravity itself, so that we could actually see it. And from the light that we get from it, we know that it's an individual star and not a collection of stars. In terms of stars in the foreground, I mean, galaxies are mostly so far away that we can't resolve individual stars. So if you see a single point source of light that is so incredibly bright that it's probably going to saturate your detector, because if you're trying to expose an image to detect a very faint distant galaxy, then you're going to probably saturate your detector with a much brighter star that's quite nearby. And so that's why you do get those big spikes on things like, you know, like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. I feel like that's an image that people are quite familiar with. You have a few stars in there that are very, very bright and have these spikes on them where the light has sort of bled into nearby pixels because it was so bright in the pixel that it was detected in. So that's usually how we can tell. Obviously, with JWST, that's changing a little bit because now it can resolve individual stars in some nearby galaxies. But still, like, from the light that we detect from them, you can tell that they're stars in our own galaxy necessarily and not, you know, part of a collection much further away. Again, redshift usually is what gives it away.
Yeah. Well, on the theme of JWST, we have this question from Rory Goodbody. So, Robert, can you help with this? He says, hi from Dublin. I've really been enjoying your podcast after finding it a few months ago and have gone through the whole back catalogue. As a somewhat... good work.
That's amazing.
As a somewhat lapsed astronomer, having been a member of Astronomy Island as a child, I got back into astronomy last year when my then five-year-old was interested in seeing things in space. My question is about recent rumours about JWST purportedly detecting city lights on Proxima Centauri B.
You know what? The internet has a lot to answer for.
It does. Yes.
Which of course turned out to be false. Yes.
Turned out to be.
Yes.
It never was true. It was always false.
Yes. Firstly, could JWST ever hope to detect such lights on any planet and determine that they're artificial rather than reflected light from the nearby star, and if so, how would we go about making contact with the little green men over four light years away?
Yeah, I hadn't heard about this until
congratulations,
thank
Robert.
You Rory. Yeah,
I
missed
that.
This. Yes, but
people were like, can you debunk
false.
It and I was like, no, that'd be an enormous waste of my time.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, I mean, yeah, anyway, I think it's confused. There was the discovery of auroras, so northern and southern lights on a brown dwarf, and I think it spiraled out from that. So a brown dwarf is an object intermediate between a star and a planet, but yes, there are no detections of lights on planets around other stars at this point. It's an interesting one in the sense that what you'd be saying is, assuming this civilization, you'd like to think they're much more advanced than us, and that they're still doing light pollution, which is slightly depressing, but there we go. But essentially, it's impossible for JWST to see those lights. And there are several reasons. One would be that if they're anything like the lights we have on Earth, you know, and they're emitting invisible wavelengths like modern LEDs, then JWST wouldn't be well placed to detect them because of where it operates in the mid-infrared. But mainly because even the nearest star is so far away, those lights would be fantastically faint. And JWST can't even see Earth-sized planets directly, really, unless there's something that I've missed about it. You know, they're simply too faint and too small and typically too close to their stars. Now, some next generation telescopes coming on stream like the ELT, that's one of the things they might be able to do for the nearest stars, but JWST can't. It's just not quite big enough. Now, the other part of the question, what would we do to make contact with the little green men? Well, I think it's funny, there are lots of discussions about this, about whether we should contact aliens if we actually hear from them or detect them, and all of the ethical considerations about what that means. But assuming we wanted to, I guess there are various things we could do, like send radio signals and also devise light signals of our own too, you know, to see whether they might detect those, and then expect that it's going to be an 8-year reply time, which is a lot better probably than most of the, if there are alien civilizations out there, and that's very debatable, but if there are, then we'd typically be looking at hundreds or even thousands of years for reply. So 8 years we could probably live with, but lots of ethics to think about around that, about whether we should advertise our presence in the universe more than we're doing already through, you know, through older TV transmissions and routine radio transmissions anyway.
Very interesting. All right. Well, thanks everyone, and keep the questions coming. You can email podcast@ras.ac.uk, and we're also on Instagram. It's @supermassivepod.
We'll be back next time with an episode all about interstellar objects, these strange visitors that pass through our solar system. Clearly it didn't come from our solar system, it came from another one. And we're like, oh, hello. And then they disappear and we're like, oh, bye. I know, Izzy, you're very excited.
I can't wait. I'm really, really excited for this one. Yeah. So,
and I'm sure many of you out there have questions, so make sure to send them in, as Izzy said. But until next time, everybody, happy stargazing.